This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. When it comes to communication, we have a lot in common with birds. Both they and we learn from our parents, and other members of our species can tell where we're from by our accents. It's also true that our languages change over time. If you were to listen to a bird from the 17th century and compare it to its descendants today, it might be like comparing Shakespeare to Woody Allen. So when scientist Richard Mooney decided to look at the brains of songbirds as they were learning, he knew it might have implications for us. He's able to take a high-resolution microscope and see the brains of birds at the finest level of detail, neurons, dendrites, and synapses, and then he's able to see how they change as the bird learns. His research could tell us some interesting things about the importance of early childhood and how our brains form as we develop. And he joins us now, Richard Mooney, professor of neurobiology at the Duke Institute for Brain Sciences. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Great to be here, Frank.
Also with us, Todd Roberts, who is a research associate there. Todd, good to have you here as well.
Great to be here.
So, changes, tell us a little bit about the research, Robert. Richard, what are you looking for?
Well, we're looking for the fundamental mechanisms for learning and memory. And all vertebrates, birds, mammals, humans, share many of the same molecular and cellular effectors of learning and memory, but how those are engaged to enable long-term memories that guide behavioral learning, that's almost a complete mystery.
And it's interesting in birds because birds actually learn their songs. Tell us how they learn and who they learn from.
Well, from one generation to the next, usually an adult male, the father bird sings a song that it had previously used to court a female. The offspring listen, and in species like the zebra finch, which we study a lot, a little Australian songbird, the juvenile males memorize that song, and they commit it to memory for many weeks, and then they begin to vocally rehearse their own song, and it ends up being a very good match for what their father sang to them when they were young.
Just to give you an idea of what it sounds like, we have a recording of the zebra finch. Let's listen. So that bird, digitally remastered, learned that song from his father.
That's right. And, you know, there are really two miracles here, Frank. One is that a female zebra finch finds that sexy. You know, that's something that attracts her and turns her on. And the other is that a juvenile male with no script, no text, no musical text or anything, listens to that really fast sequence of sounds and makes an almost perfect copy of it in its memory bank somewhere.
Almost perfect, but not immediately. It has to practice.
That's right. There's a really beautiful and prolonged, in some species, separation of auditory memorization from vocal rehearsal that can be months long or even a year long in some species. So we know that an auditory memory, a very high fidelity auditory memory, must be stored in the brain. And the kicker in our stuff is that we found that part of that memory encoding actually occurs directly in the motor networks that help produce the behavior later in life.
So you've got this network of cells up in the brain, and in that particular network, all engaged roughly in the same process, there is, you notice, storage taking place.
Well, that was the goal. And when Todd came to collaborate with me on this, he really seized this technology to image individual synapses in a living animal and test the idea that when a young bird heard its song, its tutor's song for the first time, that its brain would change. And it was really serendipitous. The part of the brain that we could visualize that was right on the surface of the brain was an area that was actually more involved in motor control than auditory processing, or so we thought. But in fact, hearing a tutor for the first song causes an explosion of new synaptic connections to form in the bird's brain, in the pupil's brain.
Well, tell us, Todd, about this technology. What are we doing? How does the experiment work, and how does the technology enter into it?
Well, the experiment works by first labeling cells in the bird's brain, and we can do this with viruses, so they express a fluorescent protein. And then we can go in with a high-resolution microscope and image relatively deep in the brain. With traditional microscopes, you can only see a few microns, but with this type of microscope, it's called a two-photon microscope. It uses near-infrared laser light. And with this system, you can actually image about half a millimeter or so in the brain. And what we can do is image in a living bird individual cells and the connections between those cells, or the synapses. And then we can let this bird have an experience with. We can put them in with a tutor, with an adult male that they can learn his song. And then he can learn something. Then we can go back and find those exact same cells and the same synapses in the brain and re-image them. And so we can track how individual cells and synapses are changing over time as the bird's actually learning. And we can do this for hours, days, and sometimes weeks.
So the first thing you have to do is kind of segregate the bird when it's born so it's not hearing
right.
a song. Then you get the baseline. Here's my brain without music. And now I introduce Dad, teaches me a song. And what did you see? It was
before the bird had heard its tutor, before the young pupil had heard his tutor sing for the first time, these little excrescences on the dendrites called spines, which are where synapses form between nerve cells or connections form between nerve cells, were really small. And they came and went very quickly over short periods of time, a couple of hours. Once the tutor sang to him, those synapses grew and they got very, very, very stable. And so that to us tells us that many synapses were being stabilized and built and strengthened. And there's a vast literature in neuroscience that has posited that these small changes changes to these very small structures called synapses that involve growth and strengthening are the basis of forming memory.
So here it is, and you talked about this being in the sort of the motor complex. In other words, it's remembering how to breathe, how to change its vocal mechanisms and shape its beak and open and close. I mean, you have to make the sound.
That's right, and we're not sure exactly all of what's encoded just in this part of the brain. This is the only place we were able to monitor. Presumably, there are other changes in other parts of the brain as well, but we think critical information about timing and about the rhythmical structure of the song, which we know at a motor level, this structure plays, this area called HVC, plays a role in controlling. So an idea is that hearing the tutor song sort of lays down the rhythmical structure for that motor program.
But then here's something that's even more amazing to me. It even grows more with practice. So birds apparently have their own way of saying, how do I get to Carnegie Hall or something? Practice, practice, practice. That means they have to hold the memory here as the template and then hear themselves singing against it and say, that wasn't quite right.
Right. It's really a prodigious feat of learning from memory. They only have a few instances to listen to the male. In the wild, in some species, the kind we have down here in North Carolina, Frank, the young sparrow will have just a few moments of song in some cases, and that can be enough to imprint in its brain the model. But they somehow have to do this comparison, just as you say, against some form of neural template to come up with a song that's a good match to that memory.
And I guess the hardwired part then is that part of the brain that says, when you hear this, grow, get bigger, pay attention, and become stable.
Well, this you're really insightful because this is exactly where research in our little neck of the woods is heading, is to understand how the song is evaluated in terms of good or bad, and how it's reinforced when it's good.
Because, again, it's all about getting a lady out there to love the song and love you. And here's what's interesting. These songs change over time. I think you've got a story about a guy 60 years ago who really influenced your research. Tell us that.
Oh, about Thorpe and his tapes of church bells in Europe. Yeah, this is really the genesis of modern birdsong research, a fascinating story. Thorpe was at Cambridge and got hold of some recordings that a German bell fancier had made before World War II of church bells across continental Europe. And there were meticulous records where the recordings were made, and because this bell fancier often went on vacation in the springtime, there were birds singing in the background. And Thorpe came across these. He was a bird behavior expert, and he started listening to the tapes. And I'm not really sure how he got hold of them and why he listened to them, but he realized quite quickly that he could identify the same species of birds in many of these different tapes. And then he had a beautiful geographical map of song across all of continental Europe for common species, such as the chaffinch. And he realized there were dialects. There were local variants. And that was the modern insight into song learning in birds. And
so not only can the female tell where you're from, you're not from around here, mister. She can also, this is going to change over time. That do we know that the bird song would change even in the same place 60, 80, 100 years from now?
Actually, my collaborator at Duke, Steve Nowicki and Susan Peters, have shown just that kind of drift if you do long-term recording over several decades in a given neighborhood, you find that the local dialect does change and morph. So there is some drift that presumably is learning-based. It's not totally genetically constrained.
Well, and then that might be based on the ecology, which then gives you some hint at what the female bird is listening for.
Right.
Could it be that your ability to learn and adapt is what is embedded in the song and why it's important to reproduction?
Well, again, a really interesting idea that Steve and Susan have put forth is that something about the bird's early natal experience, and particularly its nutritional experience, is reflected in how well it sings. And songbirds, like humans, invest a tremendous amount of energy into raising just a couple of offspring each season, and they feed them. And if they're good at feeding them, the birds develop a much better copy of the tutor song.
And I've left you 30 seconds for the big question. What does it mean for us as humans?
Well, I think it means a couple of things. I mean, we have a very protracted learning phase. Some would say it goes on throughout our whole life, but there's no doubt that early experience is critical for child development, and really explosive changes in the child's brain are likely to occur. The first instance of hearing speech sounds, musical sounds, and all sorts of things that we transmit culturally from one generation to the next.
Fascinating stuff. Thank you both for being on the program. Great to talk with you.
Thanks for having us, Frank.
Richard Mooney, professor of neurobiology at the Duke Institute for Brain Sciences. Todd Roberts, a research associate there. Just ahead, a man who can make mice glow. Hear about it on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned.